This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You know, there are signs already of extreme climate stress, and even government authorities quietly admit the world is using up fossil fuels that power everything. The best-laid plans call for huge spending to transition to clean energy and adaptation to a warmer world, but how can we pay for it if our financial system is already weak or breaking down? Our next guest writes as Stoneley for one of the most popular financial blogs called The Automatic Earth. She has returned from a speaking tour in Europe and North America. Stoneley, it's a pleasure to have you on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
In your recording that I heard from Europe, you described your own progress through climate change and then exploring peak oil and then into finance, looking for what will hit us soonest. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I'm a big picture person on the whole. It's not quite a linear progression, really, from one to the next. I was a biologist to start with, so it wasn't merely climate change. It was pollution of all kinds and carrying capacity and population and all manner of biological issues. Then I carried that through into energy to a large extent. I got interested in finance primarily between about 15 and 20 years ago and really decided this was something that I wanted to develop a lot more facility with, because it seemed to me that if you follow the money, you follow the power, and I wanted to understand how the world worked. And what I've been trying to do ever since is really to put all that together, whether it's climate or energy or real politique or human psychology or all manner of environmental work and finance and legal relationships and power games and all manner of things. It just seems to me the important thing is to make complexity comprehensible. Too many people focus on one single part and ignore the context. I really think you need to look at all of it, but in such a way that it can be understood.
And I suppose that's what you do with your blog. But, you know, it seems to me that we're approaching this stress point in the economy that a lot of people are very worried about on a personal level and on a social level. How would you characterize our economic situation?
Oh, dire. But most people don't realize anything like how dire. Essentially, we had a long period of rally. We had a rally that lasted about a year until the end of April. And a rally brings with it a resurgence of confidence, a sense that it's all going to be all right, green shoots of recovery, optimism again. And we're still living with that at this point. Although the markets have turned again, I don't think reality has caught up with that. People haven't realized that the trend is down again. So people really are still living in this bubble world, and they're not realizing what is coming, and what's coming reasonably soon, I would argue. I think certainly within the next couple of years, we're going to see a tremendous amount of upheaval and people having the rug pulled out from under their feet. Really, all the assumptions they've built their lives on are going to be just proven to be false over the next couple of years, I think.
I suppose that's a learning experience, but it's one we're all trying to put off. I mean, things are very good right now. The supermarkets are full of food from all over the world. Many of us are living all right, those of us who are still employed, at least. So extend and pretend, they call it. Is that going to keep working?
No, I would argue not for very much longer at all. And more people are falling off the back of the truck, so to speak. And the news gets written by the people who are still on the truck. But the number of people who are falling by the wayside is expanding dramatically quickly as unemployment rises and people simply lose access to purchasing power of almost any kind. So you're seeing a lot of people on food stamps, a lot of people running out of unemployment benefits and simply ceasing to be counted. And right now they don't have a voice, but when there are enough of them, they will. And I think we're moving very strongly towards that period where you reach a critical mass of people who've fallen off the back of the truck.
It's true, you know, they don't even seem to appear very much. They're not in television or movies or all the successful places. And so I think that's part of the role that many of us would like to play, is to be able to bring that out, that there's a new population forming. And many of those are young. I really worry about the young people. They're coming out, in some places, 50% of those kids are not going to get jobs in the things they've been trained for in colleges. They're going to be angry when they can't have all the things that their parents had, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. and that's going to be a tremendously powerful dynamic going forward, that the baby boomer generation and Gen Xers to some extent as well are essentially sitting on all the money. And the prospects for young people are just absolutely dreadful. Not only are they not likely to get jobs in what they're trained for, they'll be lucky to get any jobs at all. There simply are so few opportunities, I think, that are going to be developing for people in that position. And unfortunately, a lot of them are also enormously indebted. And it's not like they even have an asset they could sell to pay off that debt. They are simply in a state of debt slavery. And what they've worked for is not necessarily going to achieve anything for them, but the debt is still very real. And I think the consequences of that could be considerable. I feel really, really sorry for the young generation, and I think they're going to be incredibly angry with the generation of their parents and grandparents who have had control of more wealth than any generation on the face of the earth, and are expecting to now live a very long and comfortable retirement, perhaps. It's simply not going to happen. There's not going to be anyone to support it in terms of not enough money to support it, but also very much not the mood to support it either when young people are going to have to be living with so much less.
So true. Well, this bubble seems to be worldwide, but it pops in different places in different times. We know about America starting in 2007, really, and the financial stress in Mediterranean countries like Greece and Spain. But here in Canada, where I live, and in Australia, property prices are still high and unemployment doesn't seem so bad. It seems like things are going all right.
The west coast of Canada is one of the largest property bubbles in the whole world. There's a very interesting post called Crack Shack or Mansion, looking at a whole series of million-dollar properties in Vancouver and asking you to guess which it is. And it's very, very difficult to guess, as it happens. The property prices in Vancouver are staggeringly high, and it's all held up by cheap credit. It's going to have one of the largest falls anywhere. It just hasn't happened yet. You're quite right that bubbles burst at different times in different places. When I was touring Ireland very recently, people were coming up to me and saying, but my house is already only worth 40% of what I owe on it, and I only bought it 2 years ago. And so they're so much further along the line of the bubble bursting, and we haven't even really seen anything. We saw a small wobble before the rally. There was about 6 months where things were looking difficult, and Stephen Harper even occasionally used the word depression. But the rally came along, everyone went back to sleep again. And in Canada, it's actually very difficult, I find, to talk to people and to get them to understand just how removed from reality their current lives really are and how far they have to fall, and that they should be doing something about that right now. It is tremendously difficult, whereas in other places where things are already getting more difficult, people are much more receptive to the message, and they understand to some extent where we're going and are very interested to know what they can do about it. In Canada, people just tend to think, well, no, I don't think so. It couldn't possibly be that bad, and they don't do anything much at all.
And ditto Australia. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is blog writer and speaker Stoneleigh from The Automatic Earth. Well, then you've sort of led into my next question, which is, what are you advising people to do when you're doing your speaking tours?
Essentially, people need to hold no debt, hold cash and cash equivalents, gain some control over the essentials of their own existence, and be prepared to work with other people to a much larger extent than people have done in the past, or in the recent past anyway. Really, any efforts you can put into working with community, you're leveraging your own efforts. People need to rebuild local self-sufficiency over whatever essentials of their own existence they can. And that's much better done at a community level than an individual level. What we have done is outsource the production of so many things that we now have these very long and vulnerable supply chains for almost everything. We need to break down that system and go for a lot more bottom-up local production of all manner of things, so that when trade breaks down, as trade does in a depression, we will not end up simply without the things that we rely on. So people have a tremendous range of activities that they can engage in. Getting out of debt is enormous. It really is. And making sure you have some money, because the value of money will go up as the value of of all manner of other things, asset prices and consumer goods, as those values fall, the value of money will go up. But interest rates will be high enough, certainly in real terms, that debt will be just a millstone around people's necks. They have to get out from under debt. They have to hold a certain amount of cash, and they must work with other people. They'll get a lot further down the list of things they need to do if they pool resources and work with others.
You know, when I read on the net and try and follow the news, it seems to me that governments are, many of them, bankrupt, really, if they had to admit to their debts. The U.S. owes so many trillions. And not just national governments, but state governments in California and New Jersey and elsewhere are close to bankruptcy, and some city governments are already proposing bankruptcy. The banks are technically bankrupt, but they're hiding massive losses. And you've got all these corporations saddled with debt from this binge of mergers and acquisitions, and the pension funds are frightened and underfunded. So somebody has to have the money. Where did all the money go?
Well, there essentially is no money. Money is willed into thin air. When you borrow money, that creates a money supply. Paying off that debt or defaulting on it, that money is simply gone. So we don't simply have some people sitting on all the money and other people sitting on all the debt. We simply have a mountain of debt. And you're quite right, with all those institutions and corporate structures as well that are all indebted, and it's people as well. People are tremendously indebted. And that level of debt simply becomes an unbelievable burden on an economy. This is why credit expansions are essentially Ponzi schemes, because what they do is they create excess claims to underlying real wealth. And whenever you have an enormous number of excess claims created to underlying real wealth, those claims are going to be extinguished. So the debt will not be repaid, but people will be engaging in a real wealth grab, trying to make sure they get their hands on whatever aspects of real wealth they still can. This is how deflation plays out, and deflation is very much what we're facing. But this mountain of debt is absolutely unpayable. There is bankruptcy around the corner for a huge number of governments and corporations and individuals. That's absolutely true.
Is that what happened in the Great Depression?
Oh, yes. An enormous number of banks failed, and government finances were in a terrible state. Trade collapsed. A lot of people became bankrupt. Yes, absolutely, we're going to see that same kind of dynamic again, where you get the excess claims to underlying real wealth extinguished, prices absolutely plummet, and you have a period of economic seizure, because money is like the oil in the engine of your car. It's the lubricant. And if you try and drive your car with the oil light on, because there's not enough lubricant in that engine, it is going to seize up. If you try and run an economy without a large enough money supply, it will seize up as well. 95%+ of the money supply is credit. Credit is excess claims to underlying real wealth. That is what will disappear in a deflation. So we're looking at tremendous crash of the money supply, and then people who still have money are going to be hanging on to it because they don't know when they're going to earn any more. So they're going to be hoarding what they have, which reduces the velocity of money, by which I mean even less money is moving around in the economy. So that just strengthens the potential for an economic seizure. That is what happened in the 30s, and that is very much what we're facing again today. You won't be able to connect buyers and sellers because there won't be money in the system in anything like sufficient quantities.
I hear you say this, and at the same time, I have this longing for more mass transit systems and more renewable energy systems, and those are very expensive items. And so without money for change, do you think it's possible we'll remain kind of frozen in time, trying to carry on while things slowly fall apart with no money to fix them? Is that what we're looking at?
I think they might fall apart rapidly, actually. But essentially, so some things fall apart slowly. Infrastructure certainly takes a certain amount of time to decay. But I don't see these things being built because, for exactly the reason you mentioned, that they're very expensive and we simply aren't going to have the money. And this is tragic as far as I'm concerned, because I'm a great fan of these things myself. I would love to see mass transit and renewable power and a decent amount of grid investment that would go along with renewable power that would actually make it feasible, and all manner of other initiatives that would be much more localized, much more responsive to local populations. I would very much like to see that, but there is so much investment required, and quite frankly, the money isn't going to be there. So the odds of any of these large projects actually being realized are very, very low. I think the kind of adaptation that we're likely to see is simply going without and then making do with what in whatever way we can with the infrastructure we currently have, but with very, very little money to use it in the way that we currently do. So, for instance, instead of mass transit, I think people are actually going to be walking and cycling and things a lot more than simply maintaining the status quo where they drive everywhere. Because if you can't afford to buy gas and you can't afford to maintain your vehicle, then you won't be driving it for very much longer. And if mass transit isn't an option, then your options are cycling and walking. So I think it's going to be a very painful period of adjustment.
But, you know, cycling and walking is what we saw in China just 20 years ago. That's how people can function in this way to some degree. Well, when we look at this debacle, I guess we'd have to say, this real possibility of collapse unfolding before us, one question that many of us are going to ask is this based on fraud at the top? I mean, we know that the stock markets are being manipulated by robot traders and by gigantic banks. Or is it really a question of mass delusion where we all went along with it and thought we could just use a credit card to buy everything we ever wanted? So how do you put things in that scale?
I think it's a predator-prey system, and you have both. You have predators and you have prey. It is a mass delusion. I don't see it as being a fraud purely directed from the top down, from the center. It would not work if you did not have the buy-in of the mass population. And really, I don't see governments and central bankers having anything like the power they think they do anyway. I think they're a bit like the Wizard of Oz, that they look very powerful, but they're actually the little man behind the curtain. And where the power really lies is the power of the collective, the power of the bond market, the power of an enormous range of short-term self-interested decisions being made, and that the aggregate of those decisions determining where we go. And if everyone decides to make the same decisions at the same time, then you have, say, a cascade in the stock market that will simply overrun anything that governments and central banks attempt to do about it. That power of the collective, I think, is really where the power lies. So I don't see a sort of small elite fraud to simply take over everything. I think that's too conspiracy-minded. I think it really is simply a predator-prey system. I think it always has been. It simply has not recently become that way. There is a huge amount of fraud in the system, of course, but I don't see that being something that confers control on the system. I think it's merely ways to exploit one's own personal circumstances for short-term personal gain if one happens to be a member of the elite and therefore has that kind of freedom of action.
It's difficult to hear this in a way, and I think it's difficult for our listeners to hear this. So we have to think also about our psychological approach to this. How are we going to get past our own personal depression and money worries and anxiety? A lot of people just push it away. They don't want to think about it. But let's say we do. We realize this is happening. How do you handle it?
Essentially, I think it's very important to have a sense of purpose. And just because we can't save the world and we can't necessarily go out and build all our wonderful renewable energy systems and mass transit systems the way we would ideally want, we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, or at least the best possible under the circumstances. There's a lot that can be done. And I think we need to simply say, well, we can't have the best world that we wanted. What can we have, and what do we have to do to get there? So being able to work with other people, build local self-sufficiency, these things are very worthwhile goals. And there is nothing that is a better antidote for depression than a tremendous sense of purpose. That really is what people need. The greater the extent to which they're prepared to take responsibility for their own lives and their own communities, you take that responsibility onto their own shoulders and do what they can in a public-spirited frame of mind, the less the likelihood they will simply fall into some kind of depression. The kind of people for whom the consumer lifestyle is everything, and that really defines their happiness, they are going to be extremely unhappy people. I think people need to leave that behind and say, what can we build? What can we do? And let's just get up and do it right now. And people will be surprised how invigorating that can actually be. If they're prepared to say, well, the whole consumer lifestyle was unsustainable anyway, that was not going to continue no matter what we did, so we simply have to get over that and move on and build what we can. I think that is tremendously empowering, and that's one of the things I'm really trying to do with going around and talking to people, to say, don't lie down in the face of difficulties, but take it one step at a time, do what you can do, and to the largest extent possible, do it with other people, because that is the way to have this situation that we're facing have the minimum possible impact. And the psychological impact is huge. If you can minimize the psychological impact, then you keep people in a more constructive frame of mind, and that is absolutely critical.
For those who want to follow up, can you give our listeners a description of your blog and how they can find it?
Well, we're theautomaticearth.blogspot.com. And we're a big picture website, so we're looking primarily at the moment at energy and finance, because that has those two things have the shortest time frame. It's not the other things aren't important. We really are looking at a wide range of challenges, but we need to take it one step at a time, so we need to know what's coming first. Finance is coming first, and then energy. We have to deal with those in order to maintain the freedom of action to address the other things later. So we have to rescue money, for instance, from the grip of the system in order to have the freedom of action to address the energy crisis that is coming, and down the line, climate crises and other environmental crises. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to provide a roadmap, a timeline, what you have to do when, what kind of actions are coming up, what kind of warning signs are out there, and what are those warning signs telling people? So what do they have to do, how they have to do it, and what they need to be aware of? That's very much what we see as our role. And I travel around all over the world at the moment trying to turn virtual communities into real ones as part of a kind of outreach, if you like, for the website. I'm trying to bring people together, because we have a very large virtual community at the Automatic Earth, but that won't matter much when push comes to shove. When times are hard, you need a real community. So I'm going around to talk to people to bring them together and try and convey the sense of urgency that they need to do something about this while they still can.
People, you've been listening to the very strong voice of Stone Lay, speaker and author on the blog The Automatic Earth at blogspot.com. I've been reading it almost daily for the past 2 years, and I have to say, it can be an island of sanity in that sea of propaganda that passes for financial reporting these days, and it's more than finance, it's our lives. It's highly recommended. Thank you, Stone Lay, so much for sharing your time with us today.
You're very welcome, Alex.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.